from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Tyler Welsh.
And I'm Sabrina Singh.
This month on War News Radio, Changing Landscapes, we investigate the ways environmental change impacts global conflict.
We became interested in the show theme, having witnessed climate change become a buzzword in the past decade. Politicians, public figures, scientists, academics, and others have begun to think about the ways that changes to our planet will affect our generation and those to come.
Long before the popularity of the climate change debate, scholars had been writing about the impact that environmental changes, from natural causes or not, have on the world. Three main focuses in this research are resources, water especially, agricultural production, and labor, factors that affect daily life and are amplified for the majority of people living in developing countries around the world. Standards of living are affected when there is a drought or wheat production is low, both of which can force migration to find better opportunity and stability.
Scholars have been focusing on the correlation between environmental change and conflict. As environments are altered due to various factors, so the argument goes, countries are faced with new pressures that can lead to unrest.
Environment-induced migrants and refugees are a hot topic. Political scientist Myron Weiner explains that perceptions surround refugees and immigrants that they might pose political risk to, or social or economic burdens on, the host country. Newcomers can also threaten cultural identity. Millions of Bangladeshis have fled to neighboring India since the 1960s. Scholars have concluded that the shortage of land and deforestation in Bangladesh, combined with population increases, are the cause of the migration. In West Bengal in particular, Bangladeshi migration has increased the Muslim population, raising cultural tensions, and political groups have claimed that non-Bengalis are gobbling up jobs and beginning to affect state politics. Throughout India, outrage over the numbers of Bangladeshi migrants has intensified recently, with Indian lawmakers pushing strict legislation limiting their entrance to the country.
Environment-induced immigrants and refugees are not limited to South Asia, however. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees estimates that by year 2050, there will be roughly 250 million climate-induced displaced peoples around the world.
In addition to migration, scholars focus on water shortages in resource-scarce regions and their potential to take already existing tensions and push them towards all-out conflict. One such academic, John Cooley, looks at water availability in regions like the Middle East. He discusses the pivotal role water has played in the Arab-Israeli conflict, showing that the Six-Day War centered on control over water. One of the major causes of the Six-Day War, he argues, was Syria's plan to divert Jordan River headwaters away from Israel. Israel then used a similar tactic during the war by both capturing a dam on the Yarmouk River and cutting off Syria's access to the Bani Yas River. In this water-scarce region, the resource becomes both a cause and a perpetrator of conflict.
Of course, there's no single causation between environmental change and conflict, but many case studies underscore that the environment can be a catalyst for disrupting politics, economics, and basic livelihoods.
In this month's show, we examine three issues that build on the relationship between environmental stresses and conflict.
First, we examine the impact of a five-year drought on the Syrian revolution.
Then, we investigate the effects of changes in global climate on farming, particularly in regions prone to conflict.
Finally, we ask whether water scarcity in Yemen is a threat to national security.
But first, a brief commentary on the current state of environmental issues.
Wind, water,
hot, go planet!
By your powers combined, I am Captain Planet!
Planet. This is War News Radio. Sometimes it's hard to read the news without getting angry. Caroline Batten and Eliana Bisgard Church have stopped trying. War News Radio presents Filibusted, an editorial segment dedicated to news that makes us tear our hair out. This week's topic, climate change.
So we've all been hearing about global climate change in the U.S. for a while now.
Since even a Grammy for Best Spoken Word album won't make Al Gore shut up.
But hey, we'd rather hear about that than Justin Bieber assigning Anne Frank to his fan club.
Well, even our less annoying celebrities are talking about climate change. Morgan Freeman, otherwise known as God, and Alec Baldwin recently petitioned President Obama to prioritize policy on global warming. So, everyone's concerned. Except, of course, our esteemed elected representatives.
Turns out, 240 members of the United States Congress have voted that global warming is a fallacy, according to a video put together by the nonprofit Organizing for Action. Georgia Representative Paul Brown puts it best.
The idea of human-induced global climate change is one of the greatest hoaxes perpetrated out of the scientific community. It is a hoax.
Right. Because it's so much fun to make up stories about how we're actively destroying our climate.
House Speaker John Boehner thinks that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere can't be a problem because cow farts are all natural.
It's almost comical. Every time we exhale carbon dioxide. Every cow in the world, you know, when they do what they do, you've got more carbon dioxide.
Yeah, it is pretty comical, John. The fact that it's the warmest decade on record, that a massive hurricane just swept through New York City, and that the UN says there will be 250 million climate refugees by 2050, can't stand up to that brilliant logic.
Apparently, science has joined Obama's birth certificate and the list of things that just aren't good enough for American politicians.
Politicians who will be sitting in D.C. when the Potomac River begins to shrivel up. Yep. A recent report found that climate change may reduce the river's flow 35% by the year 2040. It's the only major source for drinking water in the region. Although, these days, we have no idea what they're drinking up on Capitol Hill.
Meanwhile, other governments are taking climate change seriously, putting our American reps to shame. In fact, a UK court has found Britain to be in violation of European air pollution standards the country signed on to. The verdict? The government will have to pay up. And it might have to ban cars in certain cities. How incredible! One of the most developed countries in the world with a limit on car use? Oh, can you imagine? Oh dear, could you go out and buy some extra crumpets for our tea this afternoon? Bloody hell, love! I can't go out without the car! It's too far to walk! Please let me stay in front of the telly!
And so the world saw the end of British tea and crumpets.
As so many cultural icons perish in our forward march of progress.
But actually, air pollution kills roughly 29,000 Brits a year, so we feel okay with sacrificing tea time.
The numbers in China are even worse. According to a new study by the Health Effects Institute, more than 1 million people die prematurely from air pollution every year.
But let's not be so self-centered. There are other organisms on this planet, too. And Chinese pollution is so bad, it's killing trees on a Japanese island hundreds of miles downwind.
Japanese professor Osama Nagafuchi has found that Chinese pollutants are actually poisoning endangered pine trees on the island of Yakushima. He's finding silicon in the snow.
Not that Japan is doing a killer job itself. Remember the Daiichi nuclear power plant at Fukushima? Well, turns out that groundwater is pouring into the plant's contaminated reactor buildings at the rate of 75 gallons a minute.
Good thing the Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, the owner of the Fukushima plant, has a foolproof plan. Just stick all that highly radioactive water in a bunch of storage tanks. Enough water to fill 112 Olympic swimming pools laced with strontium, sitting in 42 storage tanks on a site we already know is prone to earthquakes. What could possibly go wrong?
To make things even better, they're running out of tanks, so they're going to cut down a small forest to make room for more.
But first, they have to fix their overflow pits, which are springing some leaks. And they should probably take care of the pool of used nuclear fuel stored on the fifth floor of a hugely damaged reactor building.
But TEPCO has this covered, guys. They refuse to bring in outside cleanup experts, or to build a concrete wall to block groundwater flow. They don't need any of that.
Because they were planning to dump all of this groundwater into the Pacific Ocean.
TEPCO wasn't worried about the poisonous tritium in the groundwater, because they've dumped their toxic wastewater into the Pacific before. The Japanese public only found out about that in 2011, because TEPCO didn't think it was important to tell anyone.
Well, there you have it. A review of four of the major countries in the world, the US, Britain, Japan, and China, and their adventures in climate change to date.
Kinda makes you want to jump into the Fukushima nuclear pool.
A stellar ending point, Caroline. For Filibusted, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
And I'm Caroline Batten. It's been a pleasure, at least for us. Just kidding, it's Caroline again. We're not particularly serious here at Filibusted, but I have a serious thank you to give. To my awesome colleague and co-host, Eliana Biscard Church, who's graduating in a few weeks. Eliana is a magnificent reporter and a hugely funny human being. Her dedication, enthusiasm, and snark have made War News Radio a better organization, and I'm really going to miss her around here. Congratulations, Eliana. Thanks for all those hours in the sound booth, and for the Kim Jong-un imitations. We also have another amazing senior graduating, the ever-unflappable Aaron Moser, who's kept us sane through a lot of late nights. You guys are the best of the best.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be.
This is War News Radio. Scientists and researchers already have a general idea of the broad effects of global warming, but now connections are starting to be made between climate change and specific world events. War News Radio's Colin Smith and Sarah Morell take a look at the Syrian revolution and the ways that climate change may have influenced this particular conflict.
2 years ago, when protests and civil unrest led to a revolution in Syria, analysts were surprised. The region had previously been considered immune to the types of uprisings that characterized the Arab Spring. Recently, a new study has shed light on this question by citing connections between the Syrian conflict and severe weather and resource issues that are related to another global issue, climate change. Francesco Femmia, the director of the Center for Climate and Security, is one of the researchers who studied this connection.
We took a look at Syria and the various drivers, potential drivers of unrest that existed in the country, and got very interested in this sort of the environmental security dynamics in the country.
The issue of climate change has been getting more attention as certain activists and policymakers warn that effects like increasing temperatures and loss of biodiversity make it a problem that can't be ignored. However, Columbia professor Mark Levy says that climate change also has effects on global conflict that are only just now being understood.
It's been very interesting to see that there are clear relationships between political conflict and environmental stresses, and the climate stress seems to be, you know, one of the strongest environmental changes that is related to conflict.
One of the primary factors Francesco studied in regards to Syria was a severe drought that affected the region for 5 years before the outbreak of protests. A 2011 report by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration connected this drought with the ongoing effects of climate change. Mahmoud Halak, a Syrian high school student who came to the U.S. from Aleppo 6 months ago, provides an eyewitness account of the drought's impact.
I think the last couple of years, we had like really hot summers, so the desert was like hotter than usual, and the plants were suffering, and they had like to put more water and more things, so I think they suffered more in the last couple of years.
According to Femia, when looked at from a broader perspective, it can be seen that this drought was unusually severe.
There was a drought that had been going on for 6 years, which one expert within Syria called one of the most severe droughts that the region had seen since essentially the days of the Sumerians.
The scale of the drought was reflected in its effects on the Syrian people.
The human and economic costs of this were enormous, and in 2009, the UN reported reported over 800,000 Syrians had lost their entire livelihood as a result of the droughts. By 2011, the number of Syrians who were left extremely food insecure by the drought sat at about 1 million.
This coincided with pre-existing knowledge of the revolution's beginnings. According to Femia, Syria's agricultural population was significant in starting the conflict.
Then when we look at the dynamics of opposition to the Assad regime in Syria as well, we find that the initial focus of that opposition were in agriculturally dependent communities that had been hit hard by the drought. And that, you know, for example, Daraa was where, in an agricultural area of Syria, was where that the opposition movement to Assad really started.
So we know this drought occurred, and we know that the people it affected were involved in the revolution. But how exactly could weather conditions exacerbate conflict? Sol Tseong, a professor at Princeton University, provides insight on a common theory about how the relationship between drought and conflict sometimes occurs.
It's often the case that when the agricultural sector suffers, individuals in rural locations will migrate to the cities to look for work. And if city government and city infrastructure is not equipped to deal with the inflow of rural migrants, it can cause a lot of strain on sort of public resources. And it may also be the case that urban labor markets are unable to absorb all of the influx of rural workers.
This appears to be the case in Syria. According to the New York Times, in 2010, the UN estimated that about 50,000 Syrian families migrated to the cities from rural areas.
And that was on top of the hundreds of thousands of people who fled in earlier years. And so these, you know, were not insignificant movements of people internally within Syria that were rural to urban.
Although the primary driver of this damage was a lack of rainfall, government policy made it worse.
The Assad regime heavily subsidized wheat and cotton farming within Syria, and that was based on an assessment that in years of plenty. Essentially, that led quite directly to an over-extraction of groundwater from aquifers within Syria, which led to a pretty severe drop in water availability in Syria, which compounded with the extended drought in the region, compounded by the extended drought in the region, led to this, these massive crop failures, etc.
Mahmoud can attest to the government's sometimes heavy-handed role in the agricultural sector. Ironically, in his example, the government actually forced his family friends to plant a crop other than cotton.
And the point from the government was, we're giving you this, but we make others plant cotton instead. But that was too wrong because the soil is not the same everywhere. And these farmers are used to plant cotton, and they have amount of money that they win if we make every year from cotton.
The combination of drought caused by climate change and government mismanagement created a particularly tense environment. However, researchers studying this are not trying to claim that climate change was the only factor that caused the Syrian revolution. But given the severity of the drought, it's a part of the discussion that deserves attention.
The idea that I would push people to realize is that climate is a major factor. It's not the only factor, and it's not the dominant factor, but it is a major factor.
Femia has a specific term for this correlation between conflict and climate change.
And the way we would put it is that climate change is what the security community calls a threat multiplier or an accelerant of instability. And essentially what a threat multiplier means is that climate change exacerbates other threats to human populations, whether that be water insecurity or other extreme weather events, etc. So climate change just essentially can make those issues worse, and those are issues that can lead to unrest.
Mahmoud agrees that issues with climate were not the deciding reason for the revolution. Here he cautions us about placing too much emphasis on these types of factors over the revolution's political motivations.
I think the revolution was much bigger than this. It maybe at some point pushed some of the farmers to go with the revolution, but I don't think that was that deep. It probably had some effect on the economy. Some people kind of lost money or something. But the revolution was much bigger than that. Main purpose is freedom. We didn't have freedom.
These political tensions were and continue to be the most important causes of the conflict. However, the correlation between climate change and the Syrian revolution provides a means for looking at this civil unrest that should be considered. What Femio ultimately hopes his study will do is allow more people to see through this lens.
What we hope is that we sort of laid down a marker and said, okay, here are some of the environmental insecurities that Syria has been experiencing. These kind of insecurities really need to be taken into account by security analysts when they're looking at places like Syria, and also those who are concerned about the humanitarian situation in Syria. And so, because that'll be key going forward if we're going to ensure that Syria comes about in a better way than it was before.
With the effects of climate change becoming increasingly visible, this connection should only become more important in the future. For War News Radio, I'm Sarah Morrell.
And I'm Colin Smith.
This is War News Radio. Many conflicts around the globe are sparked by scarce resources. By reducing arable land, could climate change increase the risk of wars over food? WNR reporter Jay Clayton interviewed two experts on the role of fluctuating food production in providing stress to conflict-prone regions. What he found was that while rumors of global agricultural collapse are greatly exaggerated, environmental effects on food production in underdeveloped countries continue to be a serious concern.
In terms of climate change, is that the impacts were not all in this together, at least not at the same time and by any measure.
That's Richard Matthew. Currently a professor at UC Irvine's School of Social Ecology, Matthew is a founding director of the Center for Unconventional Security Affairs, and a member of the United Nations Expert Advisory Group on Environment, Conflict, and Peacebuilding. He argues that the effects of climate change have severe potential to increase social tensions, both in the United States and around the globe.
I certainly think it could trigger a ramping up of the sort of survivalist mentality. So, and I can see that leading to some divisions between, you know, those people who feel that they're prepared and adapting and doing everything they can, and those people who are doing nothing.
According to Matthew, while the effects of climate change on conflict are still only just beginning to be understood, they place stress on nations that may already have issues of political stability.
I think we should think of climate change as, in some parts of the world, adding another layer of stress which can be quite significant.
When the amount of arable farmland is reduced, food prices go up, and resources become scarce. This can lead to overcrowding, as displaced farmers are forced into urban areas, often with very little money, where they may be placed in close proximity to other cultural groups. Our experts agree that these can have devastating and complex consequences for political stability.
So environmental change is a form of stress. It can be part of the mix that leads countries towards a really sort of crisis type of situation.
Other experts share Richard Matthews' concerns.
So last year, we had this very famous drought, and it was across the entire Midwest. But now, if that were to happen again this year, and then again next year, that's when you would really start to see major changes.
That was Matthew Mariola, an agricultural sociologist and professor of environmental studies at the College of Worcester. Mariola has extensive experience studying the potential for climate change to disrupt lines of food production around the globe. Mariola is concerned that increasing industrialization of farms means that smaller-scale farmers around the globe may be at greater risk from environmental factors.
If they lose their crop one year, they might be totally out of farming because they have no insurance, and they have very little income in the first place, so they're highly vulnerable.
Richard Matthew also suggests that large regions of the globe might see decreases in the amount of land available to grow food, and that these regions will be, in many cases, the less developed, less wealthy, and less politically stable regions.
In South Asia, you know, India especially, in parts of South America, in large sections of Africa, and also less significantly perhaps, but probably parts of Europe.
But he claims that some nations may in fact see increases in arable land.
There may actually be some gains, Russia, China, North America.
Mariola agrees that this process occurs. In fact, even in the United States, certain states are now suitable for farming more months out of the year than they used to. But globally, it is unlikely that there will be a net increase in arable land.
My understanding is that the areas getting more rainfall are, more, for the most part, areas that are already getting a lot of rain. And the areas that are getting drier and warmer are areas that are already quite dry and warm.
Both experts express concerns for the effects of these processes on the political stability of underdeveloped nations. Many conflicts over the past few decades have been rooted in scarce resources.
In a country where it's already not uncommon to have protests in the street protesting a government, it could easily happen again when food prices go up.
When they talk about what happened in Sudan, there was sort of less water available and more people competing for it, and the government became involved, and it became, you know, more and more violent.
Richard Matthew also suggests that some of this increase in global conflict might be a bacterial one. The response of more developed countries cannot and will not be rooted in traditional military might, but in the ability to respond to the spread of disease.
So when you've got public health systems breaking down, you've got massive sanitation problems, you've got people moving into marginal environments in order to survive, you have incubators for public health crises.
The ultimate question for many people, however, is how this conflict might affect the United States and other wealthy nations. Some fear that decreased food production could create situations impossible for a government to handle. But according to Mariola, it is unlikely to cause widespread panic within more industrialized countries.
I'm not so much of an alarmist. I don't think that you're going to see the government of the United States topple over.
Matthew agrees, but emphasizes that we will need to rethink much of our security strategy.
Armed conflict? I mean, it's not something I would ever predict here, no. War is changing. Violent conflict is changing dramatically. What does that mean? Well, it means, of course, that our traditional way of thinking about national security and our traditional way of dealing with violence probably is not going to be very effective.
And Mariola made it clear that severe discontent was not out of the picture.
When the price of food starts to spike, even though in the United States that we pay the least percentage of our disposable income on food of any industrialized nation, you know, historically, all through time, there was no more surefire way to get protests in the street than people not being able to afford food.
According to Matthew Mariola, few issues have as much potential to create conflict as food scarcity.
Look, when people run out of food, that's it. There's nothing left. There's no safety net to fall back on. Food is, you have to have it every day. You have to have it for your kids every day. And so when that happens, you're going to see a lot of strife, violent protests. And then you might see governments in some places actually come down.
But many regions of the world may simply experience higher food prices. In this scenario, decreased food production will be a serious economic issue, but will not play a role in geopolitical collapse.
So overall, the supply of food is probably going to go down, and that's going to cause the price of food to go up, and that's going to affect the poorest people the most strongly, and governments are going to have to respond to that in some way. By and large, I think people will just kind of adapt to that. Maybe you'll see a shift of people into growing more food so that they don't have to buy as much.
Richard Matthew suggests that food prices best demonstrate the disparity in how climate change may affect poorer, more agricultural nations and the wealthy, industrialized countries.
In the rest of the world, it's irritating to have to pay more for everything, but it isn't the same crisis that it is in certain places.
With the global effects of environmental issues often hard to predict, no one knows for sure what climate change will do to food production. Our experts agree, however, that as food and water become more scarce, global conflict will increase dramatically.
We would be naive to think that people who suddenly lose their livelihoods and have no real hope of reestablishing themselves, we are very likely to see violence, humanitarian crises proliferate in some parts of the world over the next 10 or 20 years.
Reporting for WNR, I'm Jay Clayton.
This is War News Radio. The 10 most water-stressed countries in the world.
Sounds like a bad BuzzFeed article.
Are all in the Middle East or North Africa. Yemen, perhaps best known in the US as a target of covert drone strikes, is in an especially dire position. War News Radio's Amy DiPiero asks whether water, as much as terror, is a national security threat.
Yemen is in a crisis. But it's not a crisis caused by extremist training grounds, nor by radical Islamic clerics, nor by U.S. drone strikes.
Some hydrologists predict that many wells in Yemen will run dry in as little as 10 years.
Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton speaking just over a year ago on World Water Day.
Water resources could be targeted by terrorists or manipulated as a political tool. These difficulties will all increase the risk of instability within and between states. So these threats are real, and they do raise serious security concerns.
As of 2011, Yemen is the seventh most water-stressed country in the world. It is home to a growing population and a shrinking water supply. Internal problems, most of all widespread poverty, political uncertainty following the resignation of President Ali Abdullah Saleh in 2012, and economic dependence on water-intensive crops, frustrate efforts to manage water resources. The most immediate consequence for nearly half of the population is the inability to produce or purchase the food they need. Secretary Clinton and others consider Yemen's water crisis to be a security threat to the region and to the United States. But beneath this strategic danger, lack of water in Yemen is a local humanitarian challenge. Then again, it's easy to overlook a problem that lies under the surface, in the groundwater.
If you would only have rivers, yeah, and you would use all your water from your rivers, the river runs dry.
Frank van Steenbergen is water resources director at MetaMeta, a private research and development firm based in the Netherlands. He's worked on political and technical water issues in Yemen for the past 15 years.
But if you have groundwater, it's like you have a huge bank account, which is built up over many years. But you can use much more annually than you put back into your account.
Hydrologists call this process, putting money back into the bank account, recharge. Since the 1970s, when the government subsidized diesel and offered other incentives for farmers to grow food for exports, new irrigation techniques have depleted groundwater without giving it a chance to recharge fully. Experts estimate that up to 90% of Yemen's water goes to farming. Not food staples, but water-intensive crops like grapes and khat, a popular, mild, and highly profitable narcotic that van Steenbergen compares to coffee. Because building an irrigation system or a well is so expensive, in the 70s, groundwater was often controlled by the wealthy and powerful. There are now about 100,000 wells in Yemen, but Yemen's former Minister of Agriculture, Nasser al-Awlaki, says inequality persists.
We have an equity problem. The poor is paying a lot of money for water, and if they want to get water, they have to buy it from the rich people who own the wells.
Even in the north, where khat is usually grown and strong tribal affiliations translate into better access to water, the resource can be so scarce that disputes over water rights lead to violence.
When water resources are scarce, this can also create local conflict or local competition for water.
Jessica Barry is the communications coordinator and spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Sana'a, Yemen.
There have been, over the last few years, a number of really very serious clashes and conflicts between different, not only local tribes, but between different political parties or different military parties. It has resulted in very large displacement of communities.
Down along the coasts, van Steenbergen says, Already impoverished communities are forced to migrate because of water shortages. Leaving behind their farms and villages to live in cities, poverty, unemployment, and overcrowding follow them.
The people who were affected were poor people with very little political standing, yeah, and often a very limited understanding of what was happening. So sad, but left their villages.
Where can you find a solution to water scarcity if the starting point is so complex? Mark Jansen manages the Federation of American Scientists International Science Partnership, a project in which scientists from the United States and Yemen collaborate to solve water and energy issues. He says he knows where not to start.
Ultimately, I'd say it's a little condescending to sort of conflate U.S. national security priorities, such as combating terrorism, with the human need for water.
The instinct in Washington, D.C., he says, is to put water on the national security agenda. That category would start a domino effect, mobilizing a bureaucracy of counterterror experts armed with security solutions. But making water a national security issue is a double-edged sword.
Securitizing the issue is one way to sort of focus the government's attention on a policy priority. But I would say that we should be very careful about breezily associating water security with the war on terror. Our ability to meet challenges with Yemenis in a shared fashion is really predicated in large part on the separation of that work from counterterrorism and other national security efforts the United States is involved in.
Unfortunately, the American government after the 1990s, they somehow really disappeared from the scene regarding the water issues in Yemen.
Al Awlaki, Yemen's former Minister of Agriculture.
After the Gulf War in 1991, they stopped completely their aid to Yemen. And then they came back again. But this time they came and they were much concerned about only security issues, giving government ammunition and logistical support to fight so-called terrorism.
This is exactly the concept of American aid in Yemen Jansen wants to change by having American and Yemeni scientists collaborate on issues other than counterterror. Barry at the Red Cross agrees that it's crucial to work together, but Yemenis must take the lead in solving the humanitarian problem of water crisis with humanitarian solutions.
What is really important to keep in mind is that the communities are able to help themselves. Communities should be given the means to help themselves, and more importantly, they should be involved in the solutions to their own problems.
Von Steenbergen already sees evidence of Yemenis taking charge of their water. He says young farmer leaders are interested in combining new technology for irrigation with ancient patterns of conservation. He says tribes have developed a way to mediate local disputes, preventing feuds within communities by having members of neighboring tribes raise complaints in local courts. If these community plans are sustainable, he says, they could point to solutions for water shortages elsewhere.
We should fight those groundwater crises where they occur. They will be a big global problem. So if we know how to deal with it in the hotspots, we're doing the right thing.
Once, says Van Steenbergen, he asked a retired government official why scarce water went unaddressed by then-President Saleh. The official said one reason is that there are easier issues to face, like terrorism.
Because he says, A, you get a lot of money to work on it, and B, it's not a big problem.
Yemen today is in crisis. Or rather, it is trying to balance water and food crises with a terror threat that can seem easier to handle by comparison. For War News Radio, I'm Amy DePiro.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Aaron Moser, Patrick Hahn, Varun Prasad, and Chloe Wittenberg. I'm Tyler Welsh.
And I'm Sabrina Singh. Until next time, thanks for listening.